Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we have a fabulous show, as always, for you. We're going to be talking about coaching juniors in the U.S. and what's going on in the coaching world, what we're doing well, what we might need to do a little bit better in terms of coaching, and for you parents, things that you need to look for in a coach for your kid, what questions you can ask, and things of that matter. So I've got two fabulous junior coaches on with us today, Jeff Salzenstein and Tim Seals. I'm going to bring them on the air in just a moment. But really quickly, I wanted to just let you guys know I am back from the U.S. Open. Sadly, didn't get to stay through the final weekend, but had an incredible time. And if you haven't yet, please take some time to go to parentingaces.com and listen to the interviews that I was able to do while I was there. I got to interview some college coaches, some junior coaches, former players that are now working in various aspects in the tennis world, tennis parents of some of the junior players, also some of the professional player parents. And they really shared some amazing information, and I learned a lot. I hope you will, too. So go to parentingaces.com and check those out. Leave comments or email me if you have any comments on those. I would love to hear your thoughts. I'm going to go to a commercial really quickly. If you would like to call into the show today to speak with Jeff or Tim, our call-in number, as always, is 714-583-6853. Again, 714-583-6853. I'm going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, Jeff Salzenstein and Tim Fields will be talking with us about junior coaching.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Welcome back to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we have two fabulous guests with us today. Our first guest, Jeff Salzenstein, is a former top junior player who went on to play at Stanford on their championship team, was an All-American there, went on from Stanford to have a very successful professional tennis career, and is now a sought-after coach, speaker, etc., tennis guru. You can check out his website, jeffsalzensteintennis.com, and learn a little bit more about him. Our other guest today is Tim Seals, who, as he describes himself, was a struggling junior player who wound up playing on a top-notch college team at the University of Tennessee. Tim is now a very sought-after junior coach. He happens to live in my neck of the woods in the Atlanta area. And unfortunately, we've never met face-to-face, but I have interacted with him lots on Facebook and email, and I'm thrilled to have the two of them on the show today. Gentlemen, welcome to Parenting Aces, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Lisa. I was really excited to be on the show today, especially with yourself and with Jeff, because both of you have what tennis really needs out there right now, which is an enormous amount of passion. Lisa, I know you were just a tennis mom looking for information, started a website, and lo and behold, now you just were a credentialed media guest at the U.S. Open interviewing the biggest and best names in the business. Jeff is not only was a great player, but he's a guy who's also always studying film, breaking down players, always looking to see how things are actually done on the court and not just how majority of coaches are actually telling people how to do things on the court. So the passion that both of you guys show through your tennis is really inspiring to me, and it always keeps me looking, for new and better ways to work with kids that are, trying to reach their tennis goals.
That's fantastic. And I have to just share with our listeners that the impetus behind today's show is a discussion that was happening on a Facebook group about 10 and under tennis and how coaches are using the new format to train kids and get kids ready. And one of the gentlemen participating in the conversation said, there's an issue that coaches really don't seem to know how to best use these new tools that are available to them, and maybe that's part of what's going on with our tennis in the U.S., especially on the men's side. Lisa, you ought to do a show about that. So here we are, and you guys were pretty involved in that conversation. I want to ask you to start from, because we all know that tennis goes pretty incredible in the U.S., dominated worldwide in the 70s and 80s, even the 70s. And all of a sudden, people started saying, what the heck is happening in America? Why can't the U.S. produce champions anymore? I've had a Grand Slam champion since 2003 with Andy Roddick at the U.S. Open. What's wrong with you guys? What are you doing wrong? And so I'd like to ask you two, because y'all have this incredible history of our sport. Here, what was going on coaching-wise in the 70s and 80s, and maybe even in the 90s, so what's going on now? And Jeff, maybe you can start with us.
Lisa, you were breaking up a little bit, so I don't know if it's my connection or not, but I think I got the gist of it.
Jeff, I didn't hear that well either, but I got the gist of it. Go ahead.
And so what I was hearing was what's going on with American tennis now. We had Andy Roddick as a Grand Slam champion 10 years ago. Is that basically what you're asking, Lisa?
Hearing what we were doing coaching-wise in the 70s, 80s, and even 90s to what we're doing now, why aren't we producing these champions now?
Sure. Well, obviously there are several factors, and I know that Tim has a lot of knowledge and a lot of opinions as well, so I think we're going to have a lot of fun with this call today. First of all, like I said, there's many layers to it, but what really strikes me based on my own experience is that as I was playing on the professional tour, I turned pro in 1996, and I retired in 2007. So I was kind of on the tail end of that 70s and 80s swing where America was dominating. And when I got on the tour, it was starting to move more, there was much more international flair to the game. And no disrespect to the players from, America the past, in the 70s or 80s. I mean, wonderful tennis players, obviously. But I think the information and the way that tennis is played and taught has certainly evolved and changed. And you see that with, I would say, more of a European style of play, the Spanish, the French, the Czechs. Certainly they have an approach that is, I think, a different way of playing tennis than maybe what our American type players were playing in the 70s and 80s, serving volley, moving forward, playing a lot of offense. So one of my limitations is I didn't really play defense that well, and I didn't learn how to play defense, and no American coach taught me from age 6 until 28 years old. So I never came across an American coach at that time who could teach me. And so fortunately now we actually have a lot of people in this country that actually understand how to teach this information that's been applied over in Spain and France. And so that, like I said, there are many factors, but that's what really strikes me as, again, no disrespect to older coaches from the United States, but I think the style of play has changed. And if you're a veteran coach, you better be evolving with the styles.
I'd agree with that. I mean, there's a lot of things like Jeff said. It's multifaceted. There's a lot of different layers. I mean, tennis has also, you know, through the years has gone through a lot of different, you know, periods where you had the Aussies were very dominant. You had you know, great players from America and the Connors, you know, leading up to, you know, the Sampras and Agassi, you know, Chang type era. You had a period where the Swedes, which, you know, is a very, very small country, you know, were just putting out players left, right, and sideways, a lot of them with that defensive style, and then that kind of transformed over into the Spaniards. But I think in America, what you had was back in the 70s and especially in the 80s, you know, you had a lot of very, you know, independent, creative, out-of-the-box thinking kind of coaches that were scattered around the country who were producing really good players. Now, on a small scale, you had in New York, you had the Port Washington Tennis Academy, which kind of did things kind of on a local basis. But then along came this guy, you know, who I love, Nick Bollettieri, and started changing the way that people started thinking about doing tennis with this academy business. And, you know, Nick was never very shy about going after players, and if he wanted a player, not only would he bring the player there, but if it was necessary, he'd bring the coach and hire them. And that's a policy that I think he still even will try to this day, as you can see the Harrison brothers are training at IMG, and their father's even there coaching. So, you know, back in the days, if he wanted a top girl, Susan Sloan, and he needed to bring her and her coach, Fritz Nau, to get her as the deal, that would happen. So then all of a sudden, you know, you had these great coaches like a Robert Lansdorp and a lot of other guys all over the country who were really good at what they did, and now all of a sudden every player basically east of the Mississippi and from foreign countries were all now migrating down to Florida, and they were training academy style. So, and I think the way that kind of tennis was approached in America started to change, and also coaches started saying, hey, you know, this is a great idea. I can run an academy, and I can, you know, really make a lot more money running an academy than just teaching my private lessons, where I think the private lessons were kind of the foundation of, you know, the 70s and early 80s, the core of American tennis. So that, and with the globalization, I think things really started to change, you know, through the 80s, you know, and 90s, where the rest of the world started catching up to the U.S.
We have a caller on the line. I'm going to just see if they have a question. Caller from 800-234, are you there? Caller from 800-234. Are you on the line? Okay, so maybe they're just listening to the show from their phone. so we'll keep going. Okay, so we shift from this individual training to this academy-style training. Tennis became much more of a global sport, but the coaching in our country still looks different than what it looks like abroad. Can y'all talk a little bit about that? And those of our listeners who read ParentingAces.com, I know that my son has just been training over in Spain for a month, so I'm going to hold my comments about that until another time, because I really want to hear from you guys today. But suffice it to say that my son, even after a month, came back realizing that things are very different over there than they are here.
Go ahead, Jeff.
You want to take this one? Okay, I'll take it. So two things come to mind. Number one, over in Spain, and again, it's been mentioned on Facebook posts, but the mentality over there is by the time you're 16, you're going to be playing futures. So they are groomed, if they're exceptional players, they're groomed to be professional tennis players. Here in America, you have many, many more choices, activities, sports, video games, go to college, not go to college. So I think just from the start, the mentality when they step on the tennis court is much different than the mentality here as a norm. I mean, obviously there are exceptions, and there are players here in the U.S. that step on the court with the aspirations of being pro tennis players. But like I said, the mentality is much different. And the coach's mentality, as Tim alluded to, is different over there. These coaches over there are thinking about how they can develop professional tennis players and are working a lot of times in a one-on-one setting or a two-on-one setting every day for hours on end. And so you add 10 years to that, and you're going to have some pretty exceptional players coming out of there. The second concept is an example I can use from a student that I've worked with the last five years. She's a top nationally ranked player from Colorado, no less. Believe it or not, we actually have one or two decent players from Colorado. I don't know how that happens, but she also has spent time at IMG, has spent time at the USTA, and I was her personal coach starting at age 10. And at age 12, 13, she started making a transition to these places in Florida. And I certainly wasn't opposed to it because I knew that she needed a higher level of competition. But my challenge was every time she came back to see me, I felt like I had to fix the serve. I felt like I had to reinforce to her that the swing volley was actually okay when another coach down there who is well-respected in a program said never use a swing volley. And so you get into this challenge working with either federations or academies or coaches that have their approach. And I'm not saying it's wrong, but certainly it makes my job more difficult when I see a player and I see technique breakdown or I see certain shots not being developed that I know will need to be there in 5 years' time. So I think when you have a lot of differences in coaching philosophy and there isn't one point person, it makes it challenging.
Well, I know both of you guys have focused on the process over the results. And, I mean, I've read stuff you've written, both of you. And so from the parental side, you know, we want what's best for our kids in terms of their development, in terms of their psyche. We want them to be happy. We want them to love the sport. So how do you reconcile that situation that you're talking about, Jeff? You know, as a parent, I mean, obviously, if you get the call that USTA wants your kid to come and train, I mean, good Lord, that's a huge, you know, ego boost for the kid and, you know, vicariously for the parent. So what you're saying is, you know, we have to be careful as parents not to confuse things with our kids, but how do we reconcile all that? And Tim, maybe you can address that.
Yeah, well, this is a huge thing. And, I mean, first of all, you know, if USTA, PD, or IMG, or anybody else, you know, comes knocking at your door, you know, sure, that's an ego boost. But the first thing, you know, for me, the red flags go up, okay? Because a lot of times when people are seeking out your players, you know, they're really seeking them out not necessarily for the benefit of your player, but for the benefit of themselves, for their program, for their academy, for their bottom line, or sometimes not if they're offering you, you know, free training. I think a great picture was painted at the U.S. Open in the run that Yuzny made when they went to the box and they showed his coach and they said, this guy has been with Yuzny since he's 10 years old. Now, look, not every coach is capable of taking a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old or a 7-year-old and running them through the juniors and through the professional ranks because the limit of their expertise and their knowledge might run out. And so perhaps you do need a different set of ears at some point in time. But I think the number one problem that most parents have is the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence problem, where one bad result in a tournament or 1 month of inconsistent play from your kid, you want to jump ship and go to the next greatest coach. If you have confidence in your coach or if the coach has proven results and you can tell that the coach works hard, like I'm constantly like taking videos on the court of my players and I'll send those videos, I'll put them on YouTube and I'll send them to the parents and say, look, this is what your kid was doing yesterday, last week, this is what we're trying to do to fix it, you know, here's the flaws, you know, here are the positives. So, you know, if a coach is really good and dedicated and is willing to communicate with the parents, you know, every step of the way, a lot of times a coach not just has to coach the kids, but you have to educate the parents, a lot of the parents don't know any tennis, or they know just enough to be dangerous, you know, and they can be very smart people, doctors, lawyers, you know, et cetera. So they're experts in their field, but when it comes down to the being on the tennis court, even though they're very smart people, they still don't necessarily get it, what's going on with their kids. So, you know, as a coach, you have to be both a little bit psychiatrist, psychologist, technical expert, fitness coach, and a lot of other things. And that's another area that I really, you know, that Jeff is really great in. I mean, he's always looking for the, you know, the best nutrition, the best fitness exercises, the yoga, you know, the tennis, everything to become not only just a better player, but to be a better human being and a better, you know, person in life. So, I mean, I think that's the same thing that I strive for when I'm working with students.
So, Lisa, you had asked, you know, what do we do? And, you know, that is the billion-dollar question here, because, you know, the challenge that we're faced with here is that as a parent, if you have that opportunity, like you said, how do you turn that down? You know, you have an opportunity to get free training at an IMG or a USTA. How do you say no to that and stay in Colorado or stay in, you know, Virginia or wherever you live when you have an incredible opportunity? I think so really parents are in a challenging situation because of the things that Tim mentioned, that, you know, the best interest of the player is not always being looked after. I mean, like I said, I've got this girl that I'm working with now. She's back in Colorado going to public school. She just banged up her shoulder, but what if she was down in Florida and hurt her shoulder? They might say play through it or, you know, keep hitting or whatever, but we can really monitor her and really take care of her. So, you know, as a parent, I would start asking a lot of questions as to how that personal development for your child is, what's going to look like, and really try to drill it down. And I really believe that the USTA, I know they're trying to do it the right way, to do it the way they think is right, but they certainly could make some adjustments that would make things, you know, a lot more efficient and a lot more productive.
I think Patrick has started to address that now. I think he kind of is seeing that the model doesn't work, you know, and the kids, I guess, starting this year down in Boca, they're changing. They're not having nearly as many kids living in the dorms, far less, actually. I think maybe only three or four people are going to be living there full-time, and they're going to, you know, try to work more with the individual coaches and provide more resources. So I really hope that that's what's going to take place, because I think that, you know, a model where you have the enormous power of the USTA behind smart, hardworking, you know, 60-hour-a-week working coaches on the private level is really where the future lies, you know, in developing good players. I mean, I think that's the best of both worlds, when you have the resources behind you, but you don't take away, you know, the student from the coach, and you don't discourage the hardworking coaches from saying, well, what's in it for me? I'm going to develop a great player, and as soon as I do, the parents are going to run off to IMG or Everett or, you know, or PD. I think, you know, that's a big problem that coaches, you know, coaches have, you know, a fear of that, you know, getting their good players stolen out from under them, because unfortunately it happens every day and, you know, and has for years in the coaching world.
Well, so let me play devil's advocate for a sec, because, you know, what if you have chosen a coach for your child, the coach has, let's say, 15, 20 kids that they work with, and one of those kids gets called down to Florida or to PD elsewhere. If I'm the parent whose kid is not being called down, I'm the one whose kid is still here, but my coach is being pulled, you know, to one of these big academies to work with that one child. I mean, that causes a big issue too, you know, for the kids that are left behind. And as a junior coach, how do you reconcile that with the rest of the kids that you work with?
Well, I mean, for me, it's very easy because I keep my numbers relatively small. You know, I keep, I don't want to say stable, but that's basically what it is, of, you know, 18 to 23 players. So I really try to tailor things on an individual and small basis. I don't want it to get out of hand, and I really don't like to hire any assistants to work with me. You know, I mean, occasionally I'll use, you know, people, you know, as ball feeders or, you know, hitting partners. But, you know, I try to do the majority of the work myself so that I'm really tailoring it to give one-on-one direction, not only on the court but off the court. And I leave myself enough time to try to work with the parents, you know, with their kids individually. So I'm not exactly sure what Jeff's situation is, but I would love to hear it.
Well, certainly in my situation in Colorado, I had a program for about 5 years, and then I transitioned and moved my content online and figured I had a bigger reach to be able to help more tennis players, both at the rec player and rec level and the junior level. But if I had a player that was going down to Florida a lot, you know, obviously the other players I was working with were not as strong, you know, and again, this is Colorado, but, you know, I think that could actually be turned into a positive. If one of your players is going down to Florida, that could inspire the other players to say, okay, you know, if I work hard, if I do these things, I'll get those opportunities. Again, the challenge lies in that I've just had a hard time being able to feel like I could make a difference when a player went to these other places. And I think there certainly, as Tim alluded to, there certainly has to be maybe some type of stipend set up where that private coach gets certain dollars, or that player gets certain dollars to choose what coach they want to work with throughout the year, whether it's $3,000, $5,000, $10,000, $30,000, whatever the ranking is, determine how much that player gets, and they get to handpick their coach. Because, again, you lose out on that consistency when your player is 13 and 14 years old and they're working with four or five different coaches, especially there's a high turnover rate as well at that developmental level at the federations. And so I really think that that might be – I hope that's where we're moving, because there are hundreds of coaches in this country that nobody knows about that could probably take a player at 10 years old and take them pretty far if they had the chance, you know, if they had the means and the financial resources and they were, you know, following a developmental plan that was supported by the USTA. And like I said, they're trying to do it with the regional training centers, but I still haven't really seen them go all out with it. And that's where we need to move if we want to have success the next 5 to 10 years.
Right, and that opens up a whole, because every parent, you know, isn't, you know, Rockefeller, you know, and every kid that is a good tennis player might have brothers and sisters that are in other sports, and, you know, I mean, playing tennis is expensive. It's extremely expensive. I mean, and especially if you're trying to, you know, you're around, you know, chasing points and chasing rankings in order to, you know, to better yourself or to try to move up your scholarship level. I mean, it can run into, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, and I think, you know, you see one guy right now who, you know, is a very accomplished coach, Roy Cooper Smith, who has a daughter, Nikki, who's down in Florida now, and, you know, they're kind of in the same boat. You know, they went and did, like, an interview, and she played really well at IMG, but they're not ready to sign her. But to play at the level consistently around the country and around the world that she needs to play at, I mean, you know, you're talking, you know, anywhere from $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, and, you know, and that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so for a kid that aspires to reach the highest level, I mean, I'm just coming off this week in New York at the Open where I got to watch the top juniors in the world compete and, you know, got to talk to their parents and got to talk to some of the coaches. And that's a very different path than the path that a kid who is aspiring to play college tennis might be on. And so from the parent side, I mean, the kids that are playing Open, most of them are not enrolled in regular school. They really have very little life outside of tennis. And, you know, tennis dictates their travel schedule. It dictates when they eat, when they sleep, all of that, and really dictates that for at least one parent, if not the entire family. So it is not only a huge financial commitment to have your child go through the ranks, you know, and make their way toward college or toward a professional career, but it's an incredible commitment on the part of the family. And so as a coach, do you discuss these things with a family when you've got a player who you see that potential in, or how do you handle that with them?
Well, you better. You better, or else they get blindsided.
Yeah, I mean, I like Wayne Bryan's quote that I've used on a couple of parents, and they may or may not have been offended, but, you know, literally the chance of making it as a professional tennis player, you have a greater chance of stepping outside and getting struck by lightning than you do of making it. So So the parents need to know that early on. Whatever course they decide, if they decide to go all in with their chips, or if they say, you know what, we're going to go the college route. You know, again, Andy Roddick was going to the University of Georgia until he started working with Tariq Benabilis. So he was on his way to play college tennis, and within 1 year, things changed. So you can follow that route if you have a very good player, and then, you know, things can change. But parents need to know that the chance of making it is slim to none. And to top it off, you know, Tim said that, you know, you have two children, they don't play tennis. People have asked me, well, if you have children, would you put your kids in tennis? I'm not sure I would, for many reasons, but one of them is if they want to play pro tennis, the economics just don't make sense. I mean, Patrick Reed won the Greensboro Open on the PGA Tour the same week that Rafa Nadal won Cincinnati, $950,000 to the winner there at the Greensboro Open in golf, $550,000 to Rafa Nadal. I don't think anybody knows who Patrick Reed is. And that's at the highest level. We still have $10,000 futures, $25,000 and $50,000 challengers. That's the same prize money that we had in the 1980s. So there are huge issues that would need to be addressed on many levels to really make it realistic for a woman or a man or a girl or a boy to grow up to be a professional tennis player and be successful at it and actually make a living.
Yeah,
I played 11 years. I didn't have a cent in the bank when I was done, and I was top 100 in the world. I invested all of it, but I didn't. You know, that's a problem. You know, that's a problem.
It is, and you know, I mean, I always start parents. You know, I try to be very logical with them. Hey, let's, you know, first goal, let's move towards making the high school team. Let's try to get, you know, good enough where we can have some choices about where we go to college, and then hopefully maybe if you're really lucky, like the lightning strikes, you know, you get to that point. And like Jeff was saying about Roddick, let me give you just a real quick story that I think all your listeners will really get a kick out of, and that I'm sure not anybody outside of like my circle would know. And that's that right after I moved to Atlanta in 1991, there was one of these challengers that was taking place here. And I had a friend of mine who had played, she had played for Wake Forest, and her parents were very big in the Atlanta tennis community. And they were housing a couple of players from Australia who were here playing in the qualifying to get into the challenger here in Atlanta. So I'd gone down there, and I met my friend, and she introduced me to these couple of Australian guys. And I stuck around and watched their matches, and it had just happened to be that one of the Tennessee assistant coaches was down here scouting a player from Canada who they wound up not getting. And one of the young guys from Australia, he lost right away in the first round of the qualifying, and he stuck around, you know, with his you know, mate getting ready to go to the next stop. And he told me he was really discouraged and that he was pretty much out of money and out of options and was going to quit tennis after the summer, after this circuit was over. And so I said, hey, look, I said, we've had some Australians at Tennessee before. Let me, in the morning, let me get the assistant coach to come down here and take a look at you. So I arranged a hit, and the coach watched him, and the coach said, you know, was very nice to them, and afterwards said to me, he said, you know, hey, Tim, you know, the kid, he's a really nice kid, but we don't need any more five or six players on our team. We need ones and twos. And, you know, that kid turned out to be Patrick Rafter.
I knew it.
Who barely a year later, got removed from that, beat Sampras in Indianapolis. So that's something that Barry Lewis, who was the one of the assistant coaches, you know, he'll never live that down, as he had a chance to sign, you know, Rafter and rescue him from his tennis woes and, you know, lost one of the great professionals of all time. So things can change, but oftentimes they don't. I mean, what really changes is I get a better scholarship offer, or, you know, I have more choices about where I want to play my college tennis. That's far more realistic, and that's really the goal. But tennis teaches a lot of things. You know, you can put a lot of years in. You don't have to be a pro, but you learn hard work, discipline, and a lot of other great things that will carry you on in your life, you know, into your business life, your family life, and a lot of other things, you know, your academic life, you know, far aside from just playing professional tennis.
Jeff, talk to us a little bit about what you're doing with your online presence and how your thinking has shifted, you know, through using the internet as a resource for people to work with you.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story. you know, playing professional tennis. First of all, the backstory with me, again, grew up in Denver. I spent 1 week at a tennis academy when I was 14 in Florida, and I remember eating Hungry Howie's pizza with five other guys in the kind of swampy, mossy, air-conditioned apartment. And after 1 week, I was like, I can't do this. This is not me. So, you know, I went running back home to Colorado to the white picket fences and the two-story suburban house with my siblings and my parents. And, you know, I knew internally that I was not an academy kid. It was just not in my DNA. And so my goal at age 12 was to go to Stanford University. It was not to play professional tennis. And so I was one of those guys on a much smaller level than Patrick Rafter, of course. But, you know, at age 17, I was 5'7", soaking wet, 130 pounds. And everyone at USTA was saying, oh, this guy's going to be a nice lawyer or doctor someday. And so I fortunately was able to go to Stanford. And when I was there, that's when I grew 3 inches, put on 20 pounds, and within 1 year, instead of serving 95 miles an hour, I was serving a buck 25. And so there are stories like that. They're very uncommon. But again, I never anticipated playing 10, 11 years on the pro tour. That was not the deal. And so the reason why I give you that backstory is because I've always followed a bit of a different path. And when I look back at my life growing up in Colorado, then Stanford, then playing on the pro tour, breaking the top 100 for the first time at the age of 30. Not many people do that because, you know, they just maybe they're not dumb enough to stay around long enough to even get to that level. But I always did things a little differently. And so when I stopped playing and I started coaching, I kind of got creative and just started blogging and thinking about how I could share the information that I had learned. Kind of, I went to a lot of different coaches and studied video and just tried to and studied all the greats. You know, I go to these practice courts. Querten is ripping down the line backhands in Cincinnati. I would sit in the stadium as a professional player and watch him and his coach. I'd watch the Spanish coaches. And I was seeing things being taught that was much different than how I was taught and much different than what I was seeing in the U.S. And so I wanted to share a lot of the things that I learned as a player and then as I was learning as a young coach. And I started blogging and creating videos. And then I learned the internet marketing piece and wanted to figure out a way to create a viable business. And we launched our first online course a little over 2 years ago. And we've got five courses now and a membership site. And it's just going like gangbusters. And interestingly enough, people say, well, do you go after junior players? Yes, we have parents and junior players that are on our website, but really the sweet spot is the 47-year-old 3.5 to 4.0 rec player that I joke in a next life they want to come back to be Roger Federer or Rafa Nadal. And that's the player that we kind of get at our website that they really want to understand the game and what's going on. And like I said, it's a nice blend of juniors and rec players, and you know, we're having a ton of fun because we can reach people all over the world with a website, so it's been great.
And yeah, that's a great idea because, I'm sorry, I was just saying that's a great idea because what you actually get on Jeff's site is you get looks at things on how things are really done on the court that you would not see if you were reading Tennis Magazine or a tennis book. you get a totally different look at what's actually happening on the court. So it's such a great idea. And like you said, he can reach so many more people around the world instead of, you know, just in his own neighborhood.
Well, yeah, it does provide a viable opportunity for a parent. You know, I get emails all the time. I remember I got an email from a parent. I think he was on a ranch in Oklahoma, and he couldn't drive an hour to Oklahoma City or Tulsa or wherever he was living. He's trying to teach his son or daughter how to play. And now he's just studying these YouTube videos and buying my courses, and he's just doing everything he can. And you look at some of the great players of the game, and women and men, many of their parents knew nothing about tennis, and they bought a Nick Bollettieri, you know, lethal forehand DVD with Agassi in his long hair, or they, you know, they figure out a way to study tennis. And oftentimes it's that parent that knows nothing about tennis that kind of found a way. And so hopefully with these videos and this information, we can get it out there and help more players.
That's fantastic. I was going to say, Jeff, you're going to be presenting at the U.S. Tennis Congress in Atlanta in October. And for my regular listeners, T.J. Simmons was on the show a couple weeks ago discussing the Congress. And so I just wanted to let the listeners know that you will be one of the faculty members there. So if you guys are thinking about signing up to come, you're going to get Jeff. And what a cool thing to have that opportunity.
Awesome. Thanks.
I want to ask you two, both of you. One of the things we keep hearing is that kids in the U.S. are soft, and that's the problem. That's why we're not producing champions. Our kids are spoiled. They're indulged. They're entitled. They play too many video games, and you know that's the underlying issue with why we're not seeing Americans at the top of the game in the second week of the slams. I mean, and in the case of this year, we didn't have an American in the fourth round of any of the four majors this year. It was crazy. But, you know, as a parent myself and as one who has seen each of my kids pursue different paths and dedicate themselves to their paths, I take offense at that generalization that our kids are soft and that's what's wrong with them. And when I had the opportunity to interview Mary Carrillo at the U.S. Open, you know, she was kind of the same mindset. It's like, you know, it's offensive for people to use that as an excuse. I'm wondering if you guys, through your coaching efforts, especially with kids, notice a difference now versus 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And I know, Jeff, you're a lot younger than Tim and me, so just take it back as far as you can. But,
I know. Isn't that terrible, isn't it?
Not a while.
Let me hit this one first, and then Jeff can follow up. There's absolutely, you know, and Mary's been a longtime friend of mine for, well, I can't even remember how long, 27, 28 years. But there's no question kids are way softer today. I mean, not that there aren't kids out there who work harder and have more things available to them in the area of fitness and nutrition than certainly we had as kids. But, you know, I'm starting to sound like an old person, but in my day and age, you know, we used to go home and we would stay out and play, and our parents would literally have to threaten us with spankings to get us to come inside. Nowadays, if it's more than 80 degrees outside, you know, you have to take a kid and push them with your foot to get them to go out the door because it's too hot. And, you know, these kids, you know, I mean, look, everybody's got an iPhone, you know, or an Android. Everybody's got an Xbox or a PlayStation. Everybody's got 50, 60-inch, you know, TVs with thousands of channels and movies and things to choose from, and every kid's got a laptop and, you know, and a pad. I mean, there are so many things running around with these kids that it's very hard to keep any of them focused if they really want to go to that level, you know, whether it's the high national level or, you know, or talent and coaching willing, you know, the professional level. So I think kids are softer, but that doesn't mean there aren't kids out there that are willing to do the work, but I think it's a little bit harder to not only define them, but once you get them on the court, that's the coach's job, is to be able to draw everything out of that kid. I mean, I have a kid right now that I'm teaching that's 11 years old, and he has unbelievable hands. I mean, he was serving volleying points against me the other day, which, you know, you don't see kids, even, you know, pros serving volleying too much. And he was coming in and hitting great volleys. But if the match is on and you're keeping score, that kid gives you 110%. But if I ask him to run some ladders or to, you know, throw a medicine ball or to even just, you know, run a few laps around the court or do a few sprints, you can forget it. He's going to do exactly the absolute minimum he can get away with to get the job done without me getting on his case. So I think kids are, you know, for a lot of reasons, are a lot softer today. But I think that, you know, a good coach can still find kids and can make them have passion for tennis so they can get past that, you know, and work hard and get the job done.
So for the next minute or two while I'm talking, I want to assume that this website is called Parenting and Coaching Aces, because really it starts with the parents and the coaches. I believe that the parents have to set up an environment in their home with their languaging, how they speak to their kids, how they raise them in such a way that they believe that they can achieve anything that's possible. It really starts there. I mean, certainly there are exceptions of young children that grow up and for whatever reason they've got that sparkle in their eye that they just want it. But I also believe in the environmental factors. And if I see a kid 1 hour a week with a private lesson, what's happening the other 23 hours? What are they doing in their daily life? And it's the responsibility of the parent to step it up to another level with, again, how they speak to them, how they act, what they allow them to do, the ground rules, how much they're allowed to be on their iPad, their computer, their phone, all of that stuff. And so it starts with the parents, and then the coaching. I really believe if we continue to upgrade the level of coaching in the United States, then more and more kids will want to play tennis, because I believe people stop playing a sport, and many reasons is because they feel like they stop improving. If they wake up every morning and feel like they can get better when they step on the court, they're going to be excited to get on that tennis court. And again, I have a situation with this student that I've talked about earlier that's top in the country, and she's working with me more now. I'm not doing a lot of coaching, but I really want to help this student. I mean, she's a slam dunk at a top 10, you know, Division I college. And, you know, if she does anything better, that's great. But she's actually really excited because I've given her drills that she can work on her own, because she lives an hour and 15 minutes away, where she can work on her transition game, her volleys, things that weren't being addressed for a couple of years. But she literally steps on the court excited. And I think that if we have better coaches in this country, better education, more open-minded coaches, and we have better parenting, then we'll create an environment where we will have better tennis players and better people.
Well, Jeff, you hit the nail square on the head, and that's that, you know, most people quit tennis because they're frustrated. Most people that start playing tennis are not playing a year after they start. It's because they don't feel like they can get better, because the information that they have in order to get better is very expensive or very time consuming. And it's the same thing with kids. The kids have got to feel, you can tell when a kid right away, when they feel like they've hit that wall where they're not getting any better, where they're starting to lose points to kids that they were beating before. And that's another reason that I really don't love academy settings per se, is because I think the kids are so smart that they actually pigeonhole, and they're like, okay, I'm better than this one, but that one is better than this one, and I can't beat that one, but I can beat this one. They start to really limit themselves, you know, in their potential. And what you said there about the coaching, you know, Lisa, we talked about this a little bit, you know, earlier in the show about the difference between, like, American coaching and European coaching. Well, you know, in a lot of European countries and other countries around the world, tennis courts, tennis space is very limited, okay? And you cannot just pay $150 or $200 to join the PTR and go pass a test that, you know, for all intents and purposes, I can take any parent that I have, whether regardless of their tennis skill, I could take them and train them for a week, and I could send them and get a certification with the PTR or the PTA. So you have a lot of coaches running around in America with the Oakleys and you know, the nice clothes and the basket that are teaching tennis, and they're really tennis enthusiasts, perhaps, and trying to make a living, but they're not really top-quality coaches. Where I think where you go to European and foreign countries, the space and the availability, you really have to be into the game in order to be a coach in one of those countries, because nobody's going to give you a court. Balls are ridiculously expensive, like $2 a piece or something. So if you want to coach in those countries, you better be on top of your game and willing to take your game to the next level to coach. You know, you don't have the players and the accessibility that you have in America to just say, I'm a tennis pro.
Well, so what's a parent do then who wants to introduce their child to tennis? Their child maybe shows some aptitude, shows some interest in the game. How do we as parents differentiate between the level of coaching that our kids receiving, and, you know, what questions should we be asking as we take our kids and try to figure out who they should be working with?
The one I'm a big believer in modeling and people that have had success, and you just follow them. It's really simple. So if you're a parent, if you live in Atlanta, Georgia, you go find the top two or three coaches that have a track record, that have done it before. Now, that obviously doesn't help the young coach who actually happens to be good, but unless you know you got some, maybe a guy coming off the tour and you have a good vibe about him and you give it a shot. But, you know, I lived in L.A. for 6 months while I was on the tour, and I was 28 years old. I was 180 in the world, and I wanted to be top 100, and there was a guy down in Atlanta, Georgia, who had developed two top 100 players within a year of being on the tour, and I had been on the tour for 6 years. That was Jerry Baskin. So I got on a plane and I flew to Atlanta to see what he was all about. And so as a parent, you have to seek out coaches in your area that have a track record. Have they developed players before? And then you start asking other parents what their experience has been with that coach. Is he positive? Is he negative? Does she or he motivate? You know, you start asking those types of questions. And that's where I would start, is looking at the track record and asking other parents of students that work with that coach, and then start to – and then dabble. Try two or three coaches and see the best fit for that particular player.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough situation. And like Jeff said, I mean, you can have young guys that are very hungry, that may not be very polished but are very eager, and maybe they've had great coaches that brought them up. So they – you know, that's what I tell a lot of my kids is that, hey, when this is all over, you know, you're going to be a whole – if your kids ever want to play tennis, you're going to be a whole lot smarter. And, you know, you can do some of the coaching yourself if you want, because you're going to have a whole, book of knowledge. But he's right. You know, there's guys that – listen, making good players is – it usually doesn't happen by accident. And the guys who can do it, they can repeat it, like a Lansdorf in Los Angeles, like Baskin here, and, you know, and a lot of other coaches that are hardworking guys. So, you know, if you have a track record of – you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years, then obviously that's a place where a parent could go and start. Now, that coach may not have time for your beginners, and he may have a feeder system where you have to work with his underlings before you can actually get in his group on the court. So that's sometimes the price that you have to pay. But, parents should, number one, you want your kid to have fun, and you want to find out, like you said, look for coaches that have a track record if you're serious about it, because you want your kid to go and, you know, start there, or at least use that coach as a reference point on how to get going, because they might not be able to help you because they're too busy, but, you know, those guys in that position, they usually know, you know, who to go to. So, you know, that's where I would start.
One of the things that really set off this whole discussion to begin with on Facebook was the use of the 10 and under format, and how, you know, some coaches have figured out quickly how to use that the foam balls and the shoulder cords and the small brackets to help the kids progress technically and, you know, through having some success early on. And others have really not figured that out yet. Can you guys talk about what, as parents, we should look for with our young players, with our 10 and under age players, in terms of using that new 10 and under format? And I think they're changing the name again. USTA is changing the name again. But it all boils down to the short courts, the foam balls, and the shorter rackets. And as a parent, what should we be looking at or looking for in a coach or in a teaching style for our 10 and under players?
You take it, Tim. I'll follow.
Okay. Well, you know, this is a topic that, you know, obviously I've been in a lot of debate on the social media over, because when it first came out, changing over to the short court and the orange balls, I'm not really much for the foam balls or the maroon balls. I mean, we use the foam balls, you know, maybe doing a little volley to volley or playing mini tennis or something like that once in a while. But you know, it basically boils down to basically the orange ball and shortening the court with the smaller rackets. And when this change first came out, I actually wrote Patrick, who I've known for 20 plus years, a really scathing letter, you know, and thinking it was an absolutely terrible idea. I was adamantly opposed to it, because, you know, even the kids that I have that play 10 and under tennis, we still train with regular balls. And then I started actually going and watching the matches for, you know, not just, you know, a month or two, but for a year. And then I started seeing the kids transitioning out of the orange balls into the green dot balls and into the regular balls. And I think what you have, and it's not going to work for everybody, and some kids don't need it, just to be perfectly honest, but I think what it accomplishes two goals. One, you've got these orange balls going in now in all these elementary schools around here, so you're exposing tennis to more kids, and they can do it easily, okay? So down the road, hopefully you're going to have a larger base of tennis players to work with that good coaches can train. on the immediate basis for the kids that are already playing that have some skill level, what I'm seeing now when they're going to the 12s is that you've got kids that are coming in making good drop shots, that are not afraid to go to the net, even though they're still too short and will still get, you know, just medium balls to go over their head. But they're playing really a more dynamic game. And I think that the reason for that is that when you're in that 10 and under court, it's not like a big court for a little kid where you can just hit out on the ball and hit a great shot. You're really restricted, you know, with the width of the court, with the angles. And it really forces you to have racket control, whether you by using short slices or, you know, or medium-paced, you know, rhythm strokes, or whether you just want to tee off and hit the ball. So I think making kids actually play in a confined area with a slow-moving ball is actually teaching them a lot of skills that they're able, with good coaching, to transition over into the full court and the regular court game. So I have really come, you know, full circle on the 10 and under. And while I don't want kids to stay there too long, I think it's a valuable transition tool, and I think as long as it gets more kids playing the game and giving coaches more opportunities to coach more players, that, you know, it's certainly, you know, not the devil's tool that a lot of people are trying to make it out to be. That's, you know, that's my take on it, and I'm sure that, you know, Jeff may have a different one, and that's fine. I think there's middle ground for everybody.
Well, I do agree with Tim, and I'd obviously like to add some more to that. You know, he said with good coaching. Sometimes when I walk around and I see kids playing on the short courts at these big kind of exhibition events, you know, sometimes it'll be like the halftime show or, you know, before a lead up before an event or something along those lines. And I see the kids playing and they have absolutely horrendous technique. I mean, horrendous. And they're just chopping at the ball. And so I kind of joke. I'm like, well, we can make a quick start court. We can put everyone on red clay, and we can also give them the soft ball. But if they're not swinging the racket correctly, it's not going to matter. And so, again, I think it comes back to coaching and how each individual coach can utilize the short court, can use the different types of balls. And I think the problems with it is that, for example, you know, I think every section is different, but here in Colorado, all the 10 and under tournaments now are short courts. And I can tell you that I've had 8, 9, and 10-year-olds that can rip the ball, and they're not entering those tournaments, and they're playing up in the 12s, and they're losing first or second round. So they're actually not developing the winning ways that you like to see. And so by having the mandate of having courts shortened in competitive tournaments, I think that's the major issue that I have with it is I felt like, hey, make the court short for satellite and novice tournaments, but let's keep the open tournaments the way that they are and see how it goes. But it's really, I think, limited the development of players that are very, very exceptional, that are very good. They're forced to play up. And that's not always a good thing at that age. And so I think hopefully the USTA will make that adjustment. And as Tim was mentioning, it's up to, the individual coach. How does he want to bring those balls into his workout? What goal does he want to achieve when he's using these softer balls? I mean, before the existence of 10 under tennis, my father was my first coach. He was a student of the game. He played Division I at Northern Colorado. You know, guy had no backhand, but, you know, just studied the game and is probably one of the best coaches I ever had, and a great dad too, by the way. But, you know, I'm 5-6 years old and I'm playing mini tennis with regular balls. Maybe we even played with foam balls. I can't remember, but we played mini tennis, the service lines. So I developed feel and I developed my hand by playing mini tennis. So this is just an updated version 30 years later with a lot of marketing behind it of mini tennis. The problem, again, is the mandate with exceptional tennis players being forced to play 10 and under events on a short court when they should be playing on a full court.
Right. That's exactly right. The mandate, I'm totally against. I don't believe you should ever, you know, I think the idea of having, you know, like a progression of like starting kids in tennis and moving, letting them play in the small court, but as soon as they hit a certain level or a certain number of wins, moving them to full court and something closer to regular balls, if not the green dot balls. I think that should be every coach's goal, is to get your kid out of the 10 and under and out of the short court and onto the full court. But at the same time, like Jeff said, not sacrificing. Learning to win is very important, and this is something that, you know, that parents don't understand, is that sometimes you need to stay at a level of competition for a little while until you dominate and before you move up. So a lot of people want to move up, as Landsdorf has said many times, to avoid the pressure. And pressure is something that you actually need when you're playing. You need to learn how to deal with it. Serena was a perfect example of that yesterday. As soon as that wind started playing in the beginning of that match with her game, she was negative Nelly for two sets, and it almost wound up costing her, you know. And Azarenka just, you know, you could see she was very focused, you know, a little bit more of what you would call the European mindset, and played right through the wind. So, you know, you need to learn how to play with the pressure, to deal with the pressure, and you need to learn how to win, and win at an early age. You know, winning is contagious.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, we are coming to the end of our show. I want to thank you both for being with us today, Jeff Salzenstein and Tim Seals. You guys obviously have an incredible tennis pedigree behind you, and I appreciate so much your willingness to come and share your knowledge with our listeners and with me, because I learn every week, too, from my guests. And I wish you guys the best in your endeavors. I will have links to your websites up on parentingaces.com on our links page later today. And for those of you who would like to share this broadcast with your friends that may not have been able to tune in live, the podcast will also be online at parentingaces.com on our radio show tab. So just click on that later today and share that with your tennis buddies. Next week, we have on the show Joel Drucker, who is a longtime tennis player, tennis advocate, tennis journalist, and he's got a unique perspective to share as well. So, again, thank you to Jeff, thank you to Tim, and to the rest of you, have a great week. Hope you get to spend some of it on the court.
Thanks,
Jeff.
I enjoyed it. It's a pleasure. Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks,
thank you for all you do for tennis.
Have a great day.